So this is what I'm thinking about. Money can't buy me love. Love the song. We know it. We believe this statement. But I want to call that into question. Or can it? And I don't think unless we answer this question, we can think about generations of generosity. Because I think this is, for me, one of the primary questions that we need to ask. Really, can money buy us love? Sounds odd. You're thinking, of course not, whatever, but go with me. Play with it for a little while. Before jumping in, though, I want to offer a caveat, and it's pretty simple. I want to think about, we all know about the challenges that churches are facing, the synod shortfalls or congregations in decline or seminaries in deficit or all of it. We get that. But when we look ahead at the challenges in front of us, I want to suggest that it's essential for us not to see our situation, our current situation today, as a problem to be solved. It's going to be very hard for us not to do that because we are wired by evolution to be problem solvers. Evolution favors people who can solve problems. The challenge is that whenever we identify a problem, 99% of the time, the answer to a problem is more information. To do what we've always done, do it better with more accurate information. And I want to suggest that things have changed so rapidly, so much in the last 25 years, that more information and exerting more energy in doing it the way we've always done it, but better, will not move us forward at all. Rather than seeing our situation, our culture as a problem to be solved, I want to invite us to see it as a mystery to be embraced. I borrow that distinction between problem and mystery from Malcolm Gladwell, one of the essays in What the Dog Saw. He borrows it in turn from some military strategists who point out that too often, that by and large, we approach situations as problem solvers, looking for more information, doing what we've done before, trying to do it better, but that on occasion, that response is devastating when a situation or context has changed so dramatically that the old rules no longer apply. So the example they gave in the military world of this kind of example is the question that the U.S. military was obsessed for more than a decade, where is Osama bin Laden? That is, in fact, a puzzle, a problem. Collect more information, you'll solve it, and eventually they did. But the other question the military at that time had to face was, what will a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq be like? They approached that as a problem also and collected all kinds of information and dragged us into a morass of complications and problems because the situation absent that ruler was so totally different that none of the old rules applied. And you can do serious damage when you arm yourself with more information and the context and the rules have changed dramatically. So that's where we're at. We are not at a place to see our challenges as problems to be solved, but rather as a mystery, because the thing about mysteries is they can only be embraced. And so part of our invitation, and I thought the icebreaker and the invitation to follow up on the icebreaker was a great opening, part of the invitation is to walk into this new world with open eyes and, more importantly, open ears and to ask questions, to not try to solve it, but understand it. Trusting that as we understand the culture and the challenges and the people around us, that God will lead us, in fact, to new ways of being and acting in the world appropriate to this culture, not the cultures of another year. So, thinking about generosity, we almost always default to thinking about stewardship programs. You know them as well as I do. You've probably done most of these, grabbed resources from different places and all of the rest, and they're all kind of great. But I'm just a tad skeptical because I have this deep-seated hunch that about 80% of stewardship resources are a total freaking waste of time. Just, I'll put that on the table. You may disagree. The number's too low. All right, generosity. This is what we're talking about. Here's why. Because most of our stewardship education continues to consist of providing information about stewardship or biblical rationales or what's going on in the church or why we need the money. And while information is great, First, we are awash in a sea of information. Most of it no longer penetrates us. When I was in ninth grade, I had this great teacher who taught, 10th grade actually, great teacher who taught me about the term supersaturation. Mrs. Hipschman took a plate, and on the plate was a dry sponge in one hand, and on the other hand was a pitcher of water, and she kept pouring the water until that sponge was sopping wet, and she stopped and said, "Class, this is saturation." And then she kept pouring, but at this point, there was no more room. All the water that went in the sponge forced more out. It pooled on the plate, spilled onto the table, eventually onto the floor. Then she stopped and said, "Class, this is supersaturation." That's where most of us are with information. What comes in now pushes us out. We are awash. And I want to suggest, too, that narrative, the stories we tell ourselves, our habits, and our day-to-day experience eat information for lunch every single day. Third, having grown up in the information age, the emerging generations particularly are skeptical of more data. What they want more than anything is a sense of what they give, that is time, energy, money, what they give of themselves has meaning, and they crave some sense of relationship, some connection to the organizations to which they commit themselves. So, that brings me back to one of the central questions I want us to explore. And that is simple, put this way. And when I ask this, I want you to know this isn't, I'm not asking this theoretically. I'm asking this very actually, existentially, and I'm asking it of myself as much as I am of you. And the question that I keep asking myself, because if I can't answer it myself, I don't think I can help my kids to answer it or my neighbors or friends answer it. The question I ask is, if we know money doesn't make us happy, then why do I keep acting like it does? That's the question I can't stop asking because I haven't found a suitable answer yet. I'm going to try and suggest some things, but this for me is the deep conundrum of the performative contradiction between my professed faith and my lived behavior. I'll just admit that. I may perhaps be the only person in the room who's had that struggle. But I will put it out there in a moment of vulnerability and ask you to be honest similarly. All right, so let's first kind of check the undergirding presupposition then, this idea about money doesn't make us happy. And I want to kind of check in on three sources that for me confirm that this is why I believe this is true. First, when we think about our faith tradition, manifold testimony, that the seeking of money or love of money simply does not lead. Across Scripture, one of the dominant refrains is it's not money per se, it's the seeking after or the love of money, or in fact the belief that money somehow completes you, grants eternal or abundant life, makes you happy. But if it's not just that, I want to think also about experience. There was an interesting study that was done on personal regret, that is asking people at different points of their life to look back and from a category to choose those things over which they experience the most regret. And what's interesting is on that graph, only about 2.5% of people name finances or money as sources of regret. Now, when they ask us to look forward and name worries, what are we worried about, what are we concerned about 2/3 of us put money near the top of that list. Whether it's a mortgage or saving for college or paying back student loans or making enough money at your job or all of the things that most of us spend will identify, 2/3 of us will identify that money concerns preoccupy us. Looking ahead and yet looking back at almost every point of our life, when we identify the things we should have been worried about, money hardly figures on the scene, which is interesting. We're worrying, obsessing about something that in hindsight doesn't concern us at all, which means there's kind of this imbalance of value. Beyond our own experience, though, I want to think about some of the research that's come out recently. When they look at income to happiness, there is a kind of median income or a lower level of median income that varies, of course, from context to context, but in the States it's around $60,000 or $70,000 annual income a year. After which point, the more you make does not budge your level of happiness at all. And it's important not to underestimate the difference money makes moving to that level of kind of adequacy where you don't have food scarcity or aren't anxious. because, in fact, it's difficult to create happy, peaceful lives when you are genuinely worrying about meal or shelter or things like that. But after a relatively modest income across the whole of the country, more money does not equate more happiness. Beyond that, that's not only true for individuals, that's true for entire countries. And as they've looked, this one tracks GDP in the UK and Britain. And as the GDP rises across the board, median happiness is untouched. No matter how much wealthier a country gets, it does not impact a sense of satisfaction, abundance, or happiness at all. Same as true with income in terms of the U.S. So we have these three things. We have this area of faith. We have the sense of our own actual experience and tons of research to in fact, validate our core conviction that money does not, in fact, make us happy. And yet, and here's the conundrum, we act, and particularly we spend like it does. And that's the question I'm kind of constantly wrestling with. Why does that happen? And if you're not sure it's happening, then just look for a moment about the issue of consumer indebtedness. This isn't mortgage debt. This isn't typical student debt. This is credit card debt that has been skyrocketing over the last generation or so. So we are spending as if we imagine we're getting something from this. What's going on? Again, this is the one that I find even more alarming. This is the percentage of consumer spending to the gross domestic product of the country. So you can look back generations for our parents or grandparents. It's around 60%. We've increased 10%. And we continue to rise. That means that this is the amount, the percent of our entire economy that's funded by the extra dinners out you might take, or buying a T-shirt when you don't need one, or giving kind of a meaningless gift that people look at and say thanks and dispose of. That our economy is increasingly dependent on that, and in case you're wondering, it is utterly unsustainable, that we cannot keep climbing and having more and more of our economy tilted toward spending rather than investing or building or all the other things. So back to that question, if we know money doesn't make us happy, why do we act like it does? And I want to offer a couple reasons. I mean, I want to take this seriously. I think there's some pretty good reasons. First, money is tangible. Or actually, what I should say is that the stuff money buys is tangible. Now, you may have your own sense of a tangible goal that you'd like to achieve. I'm not saying this is mine, the BMW X3. But if I'm going to search for something that might just represent on my weak moments what I would think about spending money on, it might be something like that. And the thing is, when you spend that money, actually, when you go into debt to acquire something like that, you can feel it, and you can smell it, and you can experience it. And I think that's really important, because when we sit in conversations, when we're talking theoretically, not actually, about the things that we believe make us happy, community and relationships and joy and all of those things, that's all awesome. But it's hard to define community. It's hard to point to joy. It's hard to name concretely or touch those relationships in the same way. And so we often offer a lot of values, particularly as we're talking about generations coming up. Don't spend your money on cars and acquisitions, all of that. Really, the things that make us happy are community. And they're thinking, yeah, what does that look like again? Where the car or the CD, oh, we don't do CDs anymore, do we? Talk about high school. Those things you can touch and hold and feel. And as we were talking about that high school era, I remember when kind of CDs came into the fore, and I remember collecting them, and my mom asking me once about why do I buy so many CDs, and I remember answering, if you can believe this, I'm not buying CDs, Mom, I'm collecting them, because that made it feel like a more noble activity. But it's tangible, and I think what's important for us to pay attention to, particularly when we're thinking about the emerging generation, is that they have grown up in the most materialistic culture the U.S. has ever known. And there's been a lot of ink spilled about the emerging generation being egocentric or materialistic or self-centered. And I just kind of want to ask ourselves to be honest about who constructed the culture in which they grew up. Was that them? No, it was not. It was baby boomers and above. So first, the things money can buy are tangible, which makes them easier for us to imagine them as a part of our life than many of the values we often hold up. Secondly, I want to remind us that story is everything. I love this saying by Muriel Rukeyser: the universe is made up of stories, not atoms. One of the books I've most enjoyed over the last couple of years is a book called Stumbling on Happiness by the Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert. If the name sounds at all familiar, in the last year or two, he's been doing commercials for Prudential. You don't need to know that, but I just find it curious myself when we turn to Harvard professors to be our representatives to sell life insurance. I don't know. Anyway, the book is kind of curious. It's not actually it's not a self-help book. And it's not actually about happiness. It's actually more about unhappiness and why it is that we often pursue things we think will make us happy but in actuality don't. So the question is that Gilbert is trying to answer, why are we such bad predictors of what in fact will make us happy, which is kind of to the root of our question. If we don't think money will make us happy, why do we act like it does? And the answer he gives from the point of view of psychologists I have found fascinating. And it is simply that when we think about our memory, our human memory, we tend to think about it like a VCR, like a video camera. And again, I know I'm dating myself. I should just have our iPhones up there. But we tend to think about it as a video recorder, that as we go through life, we're running this constant film, capturing all of our experiences, all of our conversations, all the things we see. And when we're trying to remember something, we're kind of using the internal card catalog. Again, some in this room probably don't even know what that is. Using the internal card catalog to retrieve that particular film and to watch it again in fast motion. But Gilbert's contention, or the research in psychology contends that that's actually not accurate, that our memory is a lot more like a still camera, a camera taking still photographs. And we're actually only capturing a slim fragment of all of our experiences and storing those away. So instead of the constant rolling video, we're just simply occasionally taking snapshots. And the snapshots are stored away. And whenever we remember something, we're actually not remembering an event. We're calling to mind a sliver and recreating the rest. Which means that actually, memory, what we think about as working memory, is an almost complete fabrication. It happens, we're so good at, though, picking a couple of still shots and recreating the middle based on context or other memories. We're so good at that, we do it so quickly, it's so largely reliable that we don't ever imagine it's a fabrication. But in fact, our memory is incredibly fragile. Now, to put it another way, we have lousy memories. And as long as I make it general, you may kind of be a little suspicious but willing to go for it. If I say to an individual, Claire, your memory stinks, it's hard not to take that a little personally. Now, if I say, you know, Jeff, your wife's memory stinks, I'm fine. He'll agree with that. Like, we know that the people around us have bad memories because we suffer from it all the time. It's our own memory that we're incredibly confident of. And I just want to kind of allow that moment of honesty to teach us something about our own memories, that if everybody else's memory is bad, odds are ours aren't that great also. So, quick example of how this works, or what influences or what preys upon the fragility of our memory. Gilbert cites some research where they had a group of people like this that they divided into two groups. Both of them were shown a picture of a yield sign. And then 2 minutes later, they were shown two pictures, one of a yield sign, the same one they'd seen, and one of a stop sign. And they were asked to identify which picture they had been shown 2 minutes earlier. Right? Sounds really easy. Now, again, there are two groups going through the same experience. The one difference is that one of the groups, in that intervening 2 moments, are asked to answer this question. Was there a car parked on the street beside the stop sign? Okay, that's it. Yield picture, one group in between question. Was there a car parked by the stop sign? And then they are asked to identify between the two pictures, stop or yield, which they saw. The group that was asked no intervening question, the group that just saw the yield and then 2 minutes later the two pictures, 90% of them answered accurately. Now, can we just pause for a moment and wonder about that 10%? You know, I mean, really, if that alone isn't enough to make you suspect of memory, 1 out of 10 people could not remember 2 minutes later that it's in a yield sign. The group that had been asked the intervening question, was there a car parked by the stop sign, 50% answered it incorrectly. What had happened in between there? They had begun to tell themselves a story. They had been distracted by a question into a narration of a story about a car and a stop sign, and that story, that intervening moment, sliver of a story, influenced their memory, which is really important for us to remember, that memory is regularly influenced by intervening events, the kinds of things that have happened since the still photograph we took and stored away ages ago. Or, to put it another way, memory is highly influenced by story. So what I want to do for a couple of minutes, and this is a bit of a segue, right? The first one was easy, because money, why do we act like money buys us happiness even if we don't believe it does? Because the things money buys are tangible. The second one I want to develop a little further, this issue of the relationship between our behavior and the stories we tell ourselves. So you may have heard some of these terms, master story, meta-narrative, standard story, worldview, tradition. All of those are different words to talk about, to name the story of our lives that we believe so thoroughly we do not think of it as a story. It's the background. It's what we typically call reality. And the only time we think about it is when we bump into someone who has a different reality, and if we don't kind of dismiss them or try to quash that competing story, it's kind of interesting to think, huh, how could that person believe such a totally different reality story than we do? This sometimes has happened to me as our kids have grown up and done different sporting events. You know, if you go to the soccer match or the wrestling match or the swim meet or whatever, you get to know the other parents that are coming over time, and you develop, like, they're not necessarily in-depth friendships, but they feel like that. You get to know the people pretty well, and you're talking. All of a sudden, you find yourself in this kind of conversation. It might have been in weeks just prior to the one we had, like leading up to an election. And you've been going to wrestling matches, swim matches, whatever, forever. And all of a sudden, the person starts talking about the coming election. And as you listen, you kind of find yourself, your jaw mentally dropping. You don't want it to actually drop. That would be socially inappropriate. It starts mentally dropping, and you're thinking to yourself, oh, my word. And I always thought you were intelligent. And then you catch yourself because you realize if you said anything, the person would feel the same way about you. Same news, same information, same unending awful commercials, and yet totally different worldviews that are interpreting all of that in terms of a larger master story. That's that meta-narrative. And what I want to do is to think a little bit about some of the master stories we have floated in our culture and the way they have set the terms of the reality in which we've lived, particularly with regard to the way we think about money and our relationship to capitalism, particularly. All right, so I want to kind of look over the last 1,000 years in about 2 to 3 minutes. So if there are any kind of trained historians in the room, just please grant me absolution ahead of time because, yeah, there you go. For much of Western culture, the dominant master story that we told ourselves and through which we view to make sense of reality was a faith story. And the goal or the outcome, the good, the perceived good was salvation, life eternal. And the means to that good was faith, particularly after the Reformation. I'll just throw a little pitch in. Something happens, though, around the time of the Enlightenment and the rise of scientific method and the incredible disruption of the 30 Years' War and calling into question the political-religious alliances and all of that stuff that we learned about years and years ago and hardly remember. But what comes to the fore is this kind of new skepticism about what's been called dogmatic truth and a flight to reason and rationality as a safer, better, more accurate way of constructing reality. And so in that world, post-Enlightenment, we switch master stories, that the new good of the age is progress or inquiry or the triumph of reason or however you describe that. But the primary good is the sense of intellectual progress by which we continue to subdue the creation that's in front of us. And the way to do that is through knowledge. This is Francis Bacon's Knowledge is Power. It becomes the maxim of a whole new age and story. Now, when I say this master story supplants the old one, I don't mean that suddenly everyone gave up on faith, gave up on religion, because in fact, that master narrative is blessed in time by the church, that God created us and, in Genesis, invites us to subdue creation, to be stewards of creation, and we begin to think, well, what does the likeness of God mean? It means we can think critically like God, and God has blessed us with that task on the earth. Now, over time, that master story itself is supplanted, particularly in middle, late 20th century, with a new narrative oriented around capital. And the goal or the good of capitalism is growth. And the means by which to create societal growth of wealth in particular is capital. And if you're concerned that this is going to go on this drunken left-bending rage against capitalism, this I'm trying to actually just be as accurately descriptive as I can, because in fact, capitalism has largely exceeded almost every expectation for the distribution of wealth in those areas which adopted it. Right? There's no other phenomena in the history of the world that has gotten more wealth in the hands of more people. So I just want to kind of think about this descriptively, rather than lending value judgments one way or the other. Later I'll come back to this and I'll try even harder to do that, and you can tell me whether I did it or not. But for now, there's this new master story where the goal or good of society is about growing. And you can sort of think about post-World War II U.S. as we begin to influence our economic and military might and kind of come into our own as a nation. And the means of that is capital. Now, over time, that switches from kind of capital in general, and there are a lot of things that go into capital, whether it's implements or tools or labor or all the rest, that begins to shift to money. And again, even as this story supplants the prior story of the scientific story of progress or the religious story of faith and salvation, it too initially is blessed by the Christian tradition. So Protestants in particular develop this kind of love affair with the idea that God has created us to grow capital and to share it for all kinds of good reasons. But that story is blessed by the Christian story, and then we begin to think about the Protestant work ethic and all kinds of terms that run along those lines. So it's a supplanting of a story, and yet still there's this sort of alignment with some of the previous stories that we've seen before. All right, so I just want to kind of hold that for a moment. I know that was a lot in one hand, but to think about why is it that we act as if money makes us happy? Well, the stuff money buys is tangible, and because, secondly, stories are everything, and we're living at a time where one of the dominant story, the master story, is about the value and the good of acquiring money for all kinds of reasons, but at that core is that story. All right, third reason I want to suggest is I'm trying to make sense of my own dilemma. Why do I act like money makes me happy when I know it doesn't? It's because habits are incredibly powerful. Another book, if you're looking for things just to beyond the realm of church leadership or theology or Bible, and I so highly recommend that you do, another book to read, very enjoyable, by Charles Duhigg is The Power of Habit. And again, a very capable writer for the New York Times who then survey psychological social research to help us think about the influence of habits on us. And his core contention is that, by and large, habits help us to flourish. One of the interesting series of studies that he investigates is to watch the brain scan, the fMRI, of people as they are learning new skills, and as they have committed them, doing skills they've committed to habit, that they've made a habit of. And you'll, if again, trusting your own experience, if you think about learning something new, finding if you're in a new call or new setting or on vacation and you're navigating a route you've never gone before, you're so incredibly actively engaged in directions and turning and paying attention to everything that's around you, as opposed to once your route from home to work has become familiar, has become habit, you're thinking about all kinds of things. Sometimes you're just there. You didn't even realize that you were close by. So that when we're acquiring new habits, the brain is just firing all over the place. It's using a tremendous amount of energy. And so the body is constantly trying to take things and make them habitual as an act of conservation, because it reduces brain activity significantly and frees us up to think about and do all kinds of other things. So habits are this evolutionarily designed and perfected means by which to flourish in the world. For that reason, the hold on us, once we commit something to habit, is really powerful. And they are almost nearly impossible to break. They can be changed. That is, you can divert some of the habitual activity in another direction, but it's very difficult to simply give up a habit, which is why people who are trying to quit smoking, for instance, will employ all kinds of strategies about chewing gum or having candy or holding an electronic cigarette or whatever it is. That's how difficult habits are to break. You can change them, but almost never break them. If you move in that direction of changing habits, which is challenging, or breaking them, which is very difficult, then it's difficult to underestimate the power of group support. Habits are hard to change, very hard to change alone, a little easier with group, which is part of the power of groups like AA, that you come together and you're surrounded by a community and are beginning to build a new culture that encourages you in new habits, new patterns of being and ways of thinking about the world. And so I want to think then about the culture in which we live, particularly in terms of the consumeristic culture in which we live, as a powerful narrative that is backed by the culture. It is bread and butter, part of our basic cultural master story. It provides tangible goods, things we can feel and think and point to and hold and taste and smell. And it invites a whole pattern of habits that, while initially may help us flourish, are very, very difficult to break. And in all these ways, a consumeristic world makes us a promise that money can indeed buy happiness that is nearly irresistible. That doesn't make me feel better about the kind of trapped place I sometimes feel, but it helps me to understand it. And if I understand it, then I can start thinking about what to do about it. And so that's what I want to kind of move toward next. And I have that familiar Chinese character for crisis up there, the signs of danger and opportunity, because I think that's true. And if we're going to lean into a different future, we can't simply be overwhelmed by peril, which we know about, but rather are invited to see, even in this day and time, opportunity. God created opportunity for us and for our communities. So then, four things we can think about doing together as a community and in our congregations. First, the imperative is on us to make the intangible tangible. To put it briefly, we need to start naming grace when we see it. Those stories that we briefly told about moments of generosity or memories of generosity are right down that line. When we experience grace and joy and blessing and fellowship, we need to articulate it and name it and say it and look to the people around us. Do you sense what's going on here? This is what we're talking about. This is what church is. This is what family is. This is what we're striving for. My younger brother... we're kind of all at this place where when your kids get to a certain age, you start thinking about this or worrying about this in a different way. Because even though you may feel trapped in your bad habits, you're hoping your children will do better. You know, and so my younger brother was saying that they've been orienting their kids around. They've been trying to talk with their kids about for Christmas or for birthdays. Can we start thinking about recognizing those days through experiences rather than through stuff, through gifts? Because, again, all the research will say that you remember experiences far more than you remember possessions, again and again. The trip you took, the dinner you had, all those things make a much more lasting imprint on us as people than the things we bought. And so he'll regularly say, look, here's what it comes down to. Do you want to have fun or do you want to have stuff? And the kids always answer, we want to have stuff. You know? And then he says, yeah, well, we're going to have fun instead. And when they look back, they're always glad, right? This is the part of recognizing an age that they're at and recognizing that in some ways we never quite live out of that, which is why community becomes so important. That individually we always default to the cultural story. As a community, we can imagine an alternative story. So we need to start making these intangible things tangible by pointing to them, by celebrating them, by lifting them up, by giving thanks for them, not in the secret places of our hearts, but out loud, verbally, sharing those stories of generosity and abundance. Second, we need to start telling an alternative story. The Christian church, when it's been the church, has always been an alternative community. It has always been willing to call into question aspects of, if not the whole of, the dominant cultural narrative in a variety of ways. And to recognize that as we're trying to think about how to cultivate a different spirit of generosity in ourselves and in the coming generations, that we do not need more information, which makes me feel a little bad because mostly what I've been giving you is information, but we're going to keep trying to move in different directions as we go forward. What we need is a better story. There's a deconstructive move here, and that is we need to make the critical move of calling into question some of the elements of the capitalistic story. And again, this is where you're going to test me or keep me honest, whether or not I can do this still descriptively or whether you feel I've become a total partisan. Tell me later. But here's what I want us to consider. To understand the goal of capitalism again, as growth as understood as increased production, greater efficiency, distribution of wealth, but the dominant feature of at least early capitalism, the one that was blessed by the Christian church in many ways, was that all of this growth had a goal. It had an endpoint. It had a telos. It was toward something. And that was the satisfaction of human want. And again, there is no comparable model, economic or political, available to us that has achieved that in a larger degree, the sheer satisfaction of human want. Now, there is room, of course, to call into question the cost. I get that. But for a very long time, the birth of capitalism was about satisfying human want in a more efficient way. And from Adam Smith to John Maynard Keynes, right? Adam Smith is the early proponent of capitalism, to John Maynard Smith, the dominant, we call a whole school of economics Keynesian economics because of the influence he wielded in the middle of this 20th century. From Smith to Keynes, the idea, the vision, was that that capitalism is a means to an end. That it is an interim strategy, and we'll get to a point where human want has in fact been satisfied, and then we will invite people into whole higher levels of being and relating and relationship and meaning and purpose. And if that sounds odd or far-fetched, go back and read Smith or any of the economists up to Keynes. It's there all the time, but we forgot it. Like we have almost entirely amnesia to the idea that capitalism was intended as a mediating factor, a step toward something better, and that often that something better was described in biblical terms as a relative state of people being satisfied and in relationship and in harmony. And what happened as it developed was that this Christian story faded away. And along with that, so also did the goal that growth in latter capitalism, the last 30 or 40 or 50 years, and in the era we might describe more accurately as consumer consumptionism, growth now is its own end. It has no goal. It has no end point. It has become the end point. Simply to have more has become the goal. And that the whole history of capitalism is littered by people who recognize the vices of capitalism, that it plays upon human greed or plays upon our fear, our anxiety, and that becomes one of the motivators. But it felt worth it for the virtue of satisfying greater human wealth. In some ways, capitalism was realistic. Without naming it this way, the early capitalists recognized that we are sinners and decided to harness that concern for self-preservation to the societal good of satisfying want. And that suddenly was lost altogether. Now, just think about what that translates. Because if I were to come to you and say, you know what my goal in life is I want more sleep. In fact, I don't want just more sleep. I want as much sleep as I can possibly get. I want to see if I can sleep starting tomorrow, 20, 22, 23 hours a day, if possible. Because really, the more sleep, the better, right? And you'd all think, dude, you've been in that job 2 months, too long, you know? Or if I were to say, you know, I just want more food. My goal in life is to eat as much as entirely possible. You would say, you know, we have a word for that. It's called a glutton. I want to have, I mean, you've, shoes. I just want shoes. Yeah, do you remember Imelda Marcos? Like, there's no area in our common life that we can name where that sentence would be okay. I just want to have as much of X as possible. That we wouldn't all look at each other and think, you're cracked. Except for what? Money. Money. That was not always the case. That also, if someone were to say in the 1920s or 1930s, I just want to have as much money as possible just to have money. Not to do something with it, not to better the world, just to collect it. It was considered avarice and greed, and the cultural value was to look down on that. And suddenly that's what we've lost. So that growth for its own sake is now the norm, which is such a contrast to a generation or so ago when we lifted up ideas of sacrifice, mutual sacrifice. I mean, think about rubber drives or scrap drives or not eating meat so we can go to the troops and all of the stuff that we've gone through at different periods. That was the shared sacrifice. And the more recent political invitation is not to give up more during periods of war, but to shop more during periods of war in order to keep our economy running. Right? And the minute you name it that way, and this is both parties. Right, there's plenty of blame to go around. The minute you name it that way, you realize that something has gone awry. And what's striking to me is to think about that change of attitude and the skyrocketing of student debt, I mean, of consumer debt that it has accompanied. Yeah, in case you're wondering, I'm thinking about how to reduce student debt all the time. And for just a moment, this is my own observation. I have no data to back this up, and yet I think it's interesting. If you look at the decline of the mainline church over the last 30 or 40 years, it almost mirrors entirely the way in which capitalism has just gotten out of hold and we've gone into this crazy levels of consumer debt. I think that part of the problem has been that the mainline Christian tradition stemming from the Reformation and Roman Catholic tradition and moral teaching, as that faded in the background of the story, then that other story just took over, dominated. And that finally my assessment of capitalism is there's a lot there to celebrate, but the wheels have come off the wagon. And it's just running out of control. All right, so in light of that, yes, we need to make a kind of constructive or critical move about the story we've all inherited and simply buy. I mean, you know, we're already reading about the stores that are going to open on Thanksgiving, right? And we all complain about that before, you know, Black Friday, and now it was midnight, and then there were people getting crushed, and so it was 8 and 7 and 6, and now it's 5. And people at Best Buy and Target are giving out numbers now. You can start standing in line ahead of time. So, I mean, we all complain about that, and yet we still shop. We are complicit in furthering that story. And so we need both to critique, but also to move forward and offer a better story. So as a reminder, the second most popular verse in all of the Bible across the country, the first line of Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." Now, we all know that, and so many people who never darken the door of a church know that. And yet think for a moment with me about how radical and powerful that statement is when it's uttered by individuals and communities in a world that seeks to make us want 24/7. The only way we can even approach sustaining an economy built on consumer spending is by an onslaught of ads 24/7 that seek to make you feel inadequate, that you do not have enough, that you are not enough, but if you buy X, you will be a little closer. In that culture, think of the power of coming around that affirmation regularly. Because the Lord is our shepherd, we shall not want. We will remind each other and live into the reality that we have enough and are enough and can share what we have so that everyone has enough. We need, that is, to make a constructive move. I'm stunned when Paul makes this statement. Do not worry in anything. I'll just stop there. I'm stunned because I worry all the time. And yet, Paul, don't worry in anything and everything, and by prayer and supplication, thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And then Paul goes on to say, I have learned to be hungry. I have learned to be satisfied. And the statement for me that stuck out to me now since doing some of this research is Paul admits he had to learn these things. He had to practice them. They did not come naturally. And part of the task of the community of faith today is to practice living into the reality of an alternative story. Third, invite participation. We need to ask people not just to give, but to serve and to direct their giving and to make choices and decisions. And that some of the things I've seen people do with youth groups is not simply to have a member of the youth group or of the youth be on church council, but to turn over a portion of the benevolence budget to the youth and to have them direct a larger and larger portion of that so that they can get involved and think about the organizations that they see of having value and make the pitch and the appeal to the congregation and bring them into decision-making processes. That's particularly important for our youth, to have them feel that they have a voice, that what their views, that their views matter, and that they are decision-makers, not just waiting their turn to be in leadership. But I'd argue it's important for all of us to feel like we can participate in the decisions that are made and begin to form what I would describe as a supportive culture of generosity. Two very quick examples from congregations that I'm familiar with, that I've worked with. One, a congregation, very small, first ring, suburb of Minneapolis, struggling, gone through a couple pastors, a new pastor came in, they weren't sure how long it was going to be open, and she said, I can do part-time. I have a husband who's working full-time. That's fine. Where my kids are, I'll be part-time. We can meet that. But here's what I want from you. I want to spend time talking about what is our gift as a community. Enough conversation about all the problems we have. What are our gifts? And let's live into that. And the gifts they identified were hospitality and valuing Sabbath. And so they made that their mantra. That everything they did would be done with exceptional hospitality and that they would provide Sabbath in a world that no longer knows Sabbath. And one of the moves they made a year in, which was incredibly controversial, was that they would meet on Sunday every other week. And the alternating weeks meet on Saturday evening for a meal, hospitality, and a blessing of Sabbath, and invite people, in fact, to rest on Sunday. No programs, no committees, no Sunday school, to rest, as however they define that, and then would check in. And the church continues by little drips and drabs to grow as more and more people in a harried time find the value of Sabbath, something that they all have said we could never do this by ourselves. Too much pressure to do. Second quick example, a congregation decided that they formed a core group, 20 or 30 people who were willing to read Adam Hamilton's Enough, and together to commit to not buy anything new, except obviously food or gas, I mean, no new possessions for 6 months, and formed a discussion group. They'd meet every other week to talk about a new chapter, and an online forum where they'd check in regularly and share their experiences and how difficult it was and how important the community support was, and then ultimately how liberating it was to be able to make a little space and step away from the story they'd inherited and live into a different understanding of the Christian story. Because finally, Paul's injunction is for us, not good advice. But here's a case where what feels like or may look like law can actually feel and play out in our experience as good news. Do not worry about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your request be made to known God. Because as we do, the peace of God, which passes all understanding, will keep guard, hold on to our hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Also, from Paul's letter, words to you and for you. I thank my God every time I remember you, because this is not easy work, but it is work that matters. Constantly praying with joy in every one of my prayers for all of you because of your sharing in the gospel from the first day until now. Amen.